Zawela madenu jazo jada kichivu pemete juna kusuzu vichila mutuzo chanyu nimbe padu cheson Sanje jidan soje chanuna chanyu padu tenye laki chishi jika sanu chandwa la tenje sanje dhubara shio Chanyu simchu yombaji majibana chiji jika nimba mibanya kone kondo pewar Good evening. And thank you, Fred, Angie, right? Angie, what's your name?
Yes.
Angie. And what's your center? Florida Mindful. Florida Community Mindful Center, all of you, thank you for having me tonight. The theme of the tour that I'm doing, I do this tour during the summer break of the university, every year I do. The theme of the tour is like Fred said, compassion for all beings. This is the kind of core message I bring. And part of, you may say, my mission. A commitment I did with the dying animals at the slaughterhouse back in 1984. Then I saw the animal slaughtering. That's how my journey begins. I'm trying to bring awareness about compassionate lifestyles. Basically, if you put into simple words, trying to staying away from causing suffering to the fellow animals. But at the same time, I am not only open, but I'm very happy to discuss on anything. So I would really love to encourage all of you to bring up questions, not only things that I may talk about my work, but other things relating to your spiritual practice, Dharma practice, issues that you may have been facing in your lives, whatever, anything that you want to discuss, I will be more than happy to share my thoughts and experiences. So we will keep like how many minutes, like 35. You keep the time for me, okay? It's good. I'm not very good in keeping the time. Like Fred said, we in Tibetan culture, unfortunately, like main, our main diet system is meat. The main food is meat. Particularly, the region I come from is the nomad area, completely relying on animal. All you have is animal. So they like highest altitude. Like, you know, normally we do know Tibet as the roof of the world, and from within the Tibet, we, where I come from, is like way northeastern region of Tibet, so it's just very, very freezing area. We did not grow anything. So our lifestyle was completely on animal products. And then most Tibetan, even today, when you bring up this issue, Tibetan people would just always say, we are Tibetans, we lived in highest altitude, that's our lifestyle. Those are our excuses. And that's Tibetan thing. But similarly, unfortunately, again, if you look into any Buddhist country, let it be Mahayana countries that practice Mahayana tradition. Like I believe you all know, Buddhism nowadays, today's as we see in Buddhism, there's mainly two traditions. One Mahayana, other Theravada. Mahayana tradition that comes from India, the University of Nalanda. Nalanda to Tibet, Tibet to Mongolia and those all northern area. Nalanda to China, China to all these Southeast Asian countries. Two lineages of Mahayana tradition. And Theravada tradition, from India to Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, Laos, all these Asian countries. And all of these countries are like nothing better than any other human race on the planet. And in, from other culture, like we living in India. India is a basically Hindu country and lots of Muslims also. So when we meet with the rest people, non-Buddhist people, what they expect from us as a Buddhist is like, oh, are you Buddhist? That means, okay, you are Buddhist. That means they expect us being like living really compassionate lifestyle. They expect us being vegetarian. And we are not. Other like non-Buddhist people believe so because Buddha symbolizes kindness and compassion. That was his message. Everybody knows that. So when we say we are Buddhist, the people expect we follow his teachings, and our lifestyle is not, you know, not so much with the teachings accurately. And then, not only that, oftentimes you hear from the Buddhists, like Tibetans, we have our own excuses, and others have their own excuses, and sometimes people misinterpret Buddha's teachings to justify their behaviors. And that is a common case in many religion, most of the religion, I think, even in Christianity. People always misinterpret their religion into their own taste and try to justify their behaviors So this is what I realized when I ran into the slaughterhouse. Before that, like anybody else, I never had a question. You just raised in that culture and just you go with everybody else. But when I ran to this slaughterhouse, then I, okay, this is, you know, this is horrifying. This is just horrifying. And then, you know, there's something wrong. This can't be correct. Our lifestyle is, you know, it's just in contradiction to Buddha's teaching. So then I went back to the monastery, started to research myself, pulling down the, what we say in Tibetan, is kangyur. It's the translation from Buddha's original teachings in Sanskrit and Pali into Tibetan. So I started to research, and I found how strongly Buddha has condemned about meat eating. And that is in the Sutra, that is in Vinaya, and that is in Tantrayana. All three, like we say, this is how normally we say, you know, Sutrayana, Tantrayana, and then Vinaya. Vinaya meaning the Theravada monastic lifestyle. In all three schools of Buddhism, say this, carry the same message, very strongly condemned the eating of fellow animals. So then I started to campaign for vegetarianism, trying to bring awareness. Starting from my own monastery, it's been several decades now, and I'm quite happy that slowly it became a movement. And then, of course, I got support from His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. Then when he spoke on behalf of the movement, or when he spoke to promote vegetarianism and animal welfare, then it was huge. It only not only worked within the exile community, but it went back to Tibet. It did many monasteries changed their way of life and turned into vegetarian lifestyle. And the exile community, starting from my own monastery, Sera Monastery, we started re-establishing Sera Monastery in South India from 300 monks back in 1970s. Now we have over 6,000 monks. And it's been since year 2000, completely vegetarian. I took my first step in 1989. I went to the abbot, the abbot of the monastery, and I said, if he could, I support my work. If he could make a law and make an announcement to the monastery that normally in Tibetan tradition, when you do the big prayer ceremonies, you make offerings to the monasteries in the temple. That's where you do your practice, that's where you do meditation, that's where you eat. It's just, we don't have separate place to go eat. That's where everybody bring their little bowls, and that's where you do your practice, that's where you eat. So in the temple, when the meat food is offered, then everybody kind of throw out bones and all this, like in the temple. Like, can you imagine this? And this is how we lived, you know? That was our part of our culture, you know? And you do wonderful meditation, wonderful prayers, all that, but then when it come to the time of the food, lunch, dinner, then when the food is offered, the bones come out in the temple. So I went to the abbot and said, just, this is not correct. Could you, prevent that or stop that? Could you stop this? And he thought for a moment and he said, yeah, we can do that. You know, he was quite brave actually, and he said, I think I can do that. So he did. Next morning he did that. You know, yesterday I was always called Lageshe. So and actually at that time in 1989 I wasn't even Geshe then. I was just, you know, so I was called La Kamba, because La is the name of the region I come from, the Kam area. So people, La Kamba. So so he said La Kamba came to me yesterday, and this is what he brought up, and I think he was right. And so he said, from now on, whoever want to make an offering to the monastery, it should be vegetarian. You know, we prevent or stop the meat food in the temple premises. So that was my first success back in 1989. First success. And then traditionally, when you do the Geshe degree graduation, that was less like lifetime achievement for a Gelug monastic, you know, the lifetime achievement. So you celebrate, you make an offering. And to do that offering, again, traditionally, lots of meat. Lots of meat. And when I did, we call it Tamja Tukpa. It's a Tibetan Tamja Tukpa. It was a Geshe Tamja, meaning the Geshe exam. That's when you proclaim that I have finished the entire studies, and now I receive, you know, the level of Geshe, the proclamation. And then you go through the exams, the debating exam from to the entire monastery and all that. And then you do an offering, feed the entire monastery, and then distribute donations. That's part of the tradition. And then lots of meat. So when it was back in 1991, when I celebrated my Geshe degree, I came up with a completely vegetarian tukpa, tamja tukpa. I went to Bangalore, which is the biggest city in the state. I went to the dairy industries, and I bought lots of milk and lots of butter, milk butter, and then lots of dates and other nuts and all these things. Like, so it was first meat-free Geshe Tamja Tukpa in the history, I think. And people normally, when I was doing those things, running around trying to prepare, people have difficulty to imagine, would that be something eatable, you know? This is how Tibetan people think, you know. When people say, oh, you know, people say, I can't think of a food without meat. This is what normally people say, I don't know how to cook without meat. This is, you know, just a regular thing you hear from Tibetan people. So people thought, would that be really something edible? You know, it's because you're feeding thousands of monks and cooking in the same, you know. But it came really good. It came really good, and from there on, lots of the younger geishas, they followed the same offering. And then that was my 1989 was like stopping the meat within the temple premises. And then after 10 years in 1999, I brought, actually it's 1997, I went to His Holiness. I was doing quite strongly by then, you know, because I was already connected with PETA here, and people for ethical treatment of animals. So I was working with, and then I was also connected with the organization called People for Animals back in India. So I was doing quite strongly. But still, I was facing lots of opposition within Tibetans and so forth. Then I thought, I really need to seek help from His Holiness. So 1997, I went to His Holiness at a private order just for this issue. And I share with what I had been doing, and he really appreciated, and he said, "I will, you know, I will raise these questions in my teachings and talks," and he did. So that's like big shift. Like Tibetan people really take serious when His Holiness talks. So then, with that support, I went to. We have an annual religious conference initiated by Department of Religion in Tibetan government in exile. So I went to that conference back in 1999, and I proposed going into a vegetarian diet in all monasteries, nunneries of all schools of Tibetan Buddhism, which means Nyingma, Gyatso, Sakya, Gelu, including Bon. And everybody appreciated, all the heads of the schools appreciated the proposal. Everybody says, that's wonderful, we'll all pursue the proposal. And then year 2000, I brought the issue again, and so everybody kind of came up with some kind of report that they have been, pursuing the vegetarian diet. So there has been good success. And also in the lay community, there are several organizations from younger generation and started to campaign for vegetarianism and animal welfare. So there has been some changes, with those achievements, I also went through lots of challenges. That includes making my Tibetan friends angry. In Dharamsala, some Tibetan people even went to the Indian intelligence bureaus. Making issue that because I had a big hoarding in Dharamsala in the kind of intersection, big hoarding, campaigning for vegetarianism and compassion for animal, and some of the Tibetan people didn't like it. They said I am insulting Tibetans and I'm insulting Tibetan lamas, including His Holiness and so forth. And they also went to the Indian intelligence bureaus, saying that I'm a spy of China. I'm a Chinese spy. So Indian intelligence bureau kind of started to chase me wherever I went. And yeah, it happened when I came down to south to my own monastery. I just walked into my house and my students came with some teas and offerings. We just sat. It was only a few minutes. The IB guy was right in my door and he was asking, Geshe-la, where are you going? What are you doing? All that information. And next day I was visiting in another town and he was there and he was asking, where are you going? And then said, what's wrong? What's the problem? And he said, sorry, I'm just doing my duty. So then I thought it's something is wrong in there. So I went to Dharamsala. I called up with the chief of the intelligence bureau. I said, your people are chasing me. What's wrong? You know? And he wouldn't say anything directly. Then I called up a private secretary of His Holiness. I said, I want you to look into this. This intelligence bureaus are chasing me. I don't know what's wrong with it, you know. It's kind of disturbing. And then, within a week, the IB chief called me, said, Geshe-la, sorry, we have closed your file. And I said, thank you, but I want to know why, what happened? And then he said, it's your people. It's your people. Your people made an issue, and we traced down to the root. There's nothing in there, so we have closed your file. That's one thing. And then, yeah, there are many other issues that I went through. But I'm happy with whatever I know I have achieved in promoting vegetarianism and all that. Then back in India, what I saw was this very small. Local slaughter, the meat, you know, shops, they just slaughter one or two animal a day to raise their family, you know. Like one buffalo, maybe two goats, maybe a couple chickens, and that's the means of raising their family. But now, when I come back to the West, then when you see those videos on the YouTube, and that what I saw back in India was like just a very, very, you know, small. The slaughterhouses and animal industries in the West are just really a horror story. I mean, I say this, like, you know, we humans talk about heavens and hells. Most religions talk about, including Buddhism. And I say this because we talk about those things, but nobody actually have seen hell to remember, right? And we don't know. If you look into Shantideva's way of bodhisattva's way of life, right? Then the explanation of a hell realm is completely different. But whatever, if something called hell does exist, that's those animal industries, those slaughterhouses. There can't be something called hell worse than those places. And there can't be. This is what it is if you really look into these animal industries and slaughterhouses. And it is quite obvious that those industries, those slaughterhouses exist for us consumers. They grow as we demand. People make argument, even within my own Tibetan society, people say, you know, well, we don't kill. Yeah, but you make them kill. So therefore, if possible, try to, you know, lean towards plant-based food. It's not impossible. And I'm telling you, I was born and raised in a nomad. Our whole lifestyle was about animal thing, meat and so forth. And I was like, you know, I couldn't even wait while my mother would cook. I would just grab the raw meat and eat. That's how I was, like crazy about meat. But when I saw the truth, the journey from animal to the meat, that changed my life, that opened my eyes, that taught me a million times more vivid and powerful than what I hear from my teachers and what I read from the sutras. So therefore, I made that commitment. And that's it. There's no crave, there's nothing, no problem. And people talk about health issues. I'm fine. My mother, she passed away last year at 87. She, when she knew that I'm doing this, you know, work, and she said, I want to follow you. And I said, no, Mom, you can't. And I believed that. I said, Mom, you are used to this lifestyle. And I said, I will arrange some meat, maybe once or twice a week for you. I'll make my neighbor cook for you. I said, your body needs it. And she said, I've lived enough. Now please let me follow you. And she was all fine. You know, so basically a lot of this is, you know, how you believe. It's a lot. I mean, there are many more people who has the same stories. So therefore, it's a way of thinking, it's a determination. So if you are already vegan, vegetarian, I wanted to thank you from my deepest heart. If you're not, please try to cut down slow by slow. Maybe, you know, once a week or twice a week, try to eat vegetarian or vegan. And then if you're determined, then you learn how to cook also. You know? It's you do. I mean, I love this English saying, when there's a will, there's a way. You just will is the number one thing. It's the will is number one, determination. When you determine, you always find a way to do it. So try to cut down on the meat. And there, even like now in this modern time, being vegetarian is not really enough. Even just thinking of drinking dairy, like dairy milk and all these things, if you look into the way animals are treated in the farms, still it's not just eating meat is not enough. I mean, we are still causing lots of problem, lots of suffering to the animal. So best thing is that if you really can't, decide to go towards a full plant-based food. It'll be really healthier. Even we think about our own selfish reasons for your own health. Plant-based food is way healthier, I think. My message that I'm making tour and trying to speak about. And normally I do show some video clips because the pictures speaks much more stronger than you speak. And then, of course, and then it's not only about as a perspective of Buddhism or anything. It's just basic truth, you know. I think we can even take it as a humanity. Regardless of believer or non-believer, very nature. In Buddhist language, we say Buddha nature. The potential we carry to be good. So we do have the fundamental potential, the loving kindness nature within ourselves. So all we do is try to nurture that potential, nurture that seed we already carry to develop and cultivate further in order to eliminate our negativities, infections. That just go hand to hand, you know, trying to subdue our negativities and cultivate the good quality. And that's not only thinking of a true Buddhist. A true Buddhist goal is to attain the Buddhahood, to become a Buddhahood for the sake of sentient beings. That should be the true attitude of a true Buddhist, not concerning about mundane things, day-to-day feelings. A lot of the time, people just and go do things just to feel good. You know, try to feel yourself good momentarily. Try to get some kind of relief from stress and anxieties and all this like chaos life. So you go do meditation and those things. And lots of people, but a true Buddhist, the vision is way bigger. You know, the goal is way bigger, to become a Buddha eventually. right? Because we do have the potential, right? So the long-term goal is to become a Buddha for the sake of sentient beings. So therefore, with that intention, then everything, if you develop that intention from morning, like then whatever you do during the day actually goes toward the same cause. Everything you did, any virtuous deeds, practice, meditation, chanting, whatever you do, because your actual intention, motivation is to achieve Buddhahood for the sake of sentient beings. So everything you do goes toward that cause. So therefore, intention and motivation is very important. So in the morning, normally, as we come out of bed, before running into our busy life, if you could kind of reflect within yourself and, you know, develop that intention for the day by saying a prayer, you know, may I do good for today, right? May I do good. And then, you know, ask for blessings, guidance from Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. Three jewels, like we say, you know. Like, so this is very, very important as a Buddhist. I mean, how somebody become a Buddhist? What makes a Buddhist a Buddhist? Very important. What makes a Buddhist Buddhist? Right? Meditation? Not necessarily a Buddhist practice. Meditation, Hindus does meditation. Even now, Jesuits have developed a wonderful meditation. I found that when I taught at Gonzaga. I not only do a meditation in the classes, but I did meditation for the staff and faculty. And I learned that Jesuits have developed a wonderful meditation, quite similar to the way we Buddhists do. So, you know, simply doing a meditation doesn't make you a Buddhist. Buddhist, what makes a Buddhist? Buddhist, your intention and motivation. You know, caring and loving for all beings. And then realizing that we do have the potential to overcome the sufferings, right? To achieve the state of Buddhahood, or to be awakened ourselves fully, to become a fully enlightened being, and we can realize that. Not just depending on saying that Buddha said that. No. Buddha said that, so what? There are so many other big guys have said different things. Buddha said, so what? But if you study and contemplate and realize, make a sense, then your practice become a genuine, right? Your practice become everything you do, big or small, it becomes a genuine, a powerful. Because lots of the time, like I remember when I was a kid, because you are born and raised in Buddhist culture. Like I teach Tibetans, like we are born Buddhist. People don't believe in studying so much. They just follow the tradition and they believe we are Buddhist. We are fine. right? And I remember going to temples with my parents and all that, you know, you just go with them and do whatever they do, like, you know, bowing down or prostrations or making offerings and everything that whatever everybody does, you just do, and you think you're doing good, but the hollow, nothing, empty. No, nothing. You close your eyes, darkness. It's just nothing but darkness. Right? And you try to say the mantras or chantings. You try to follow the culture, but just simply saying it's like we say parrot. You can teach parrot to say things, and they can say where you teach, but they don't understand what they're talking about, right? Similarly, you say prayers, you say mantras, but you know nothing. Just performing arts. Your spiritual practice becomes a performing arts that takes you nowhere. It's like cheating yourself, right? Cheating oneself, right? So therefore, studying is very important. Asking questions is very important. And that's because we are authorized by Buddha himself to raise questions and study and explore into for ourselves. We are authorized by Buddha himself. So then as ask question, then as you realize, then practice. Practice, like we say, shine, shamatha, right? Concentration as a meditator. First, of course, you try to learn concentration, then clarity. Right? That's the prajna part, the wisdom part. But why the wisdom part? Then upaya, the method, the actual practice, the compassion. That's where we come into six paramitas. Then try to apply those six paramitas, you know, by learning, reading, and further contemplating, and try to put into practice, meaning living it. I like the slogans we have at the Gonzaga. I think it's just kind of a Christian slogan. I like it so much. It says, live your faith. You know, it's about living. It's not about performing arts. It's living. The path you're learning, as you learn, as you realize, then try to live it as much we can. You know, and then it goes, it grows slowly by slowly. You know, you make improvement. And you, it's also good to look back then and now. And there are lots of things that you can be proud of yourself, that changes you made so far, that you learned and you have improved yourself. But at the same time also, there are lot to do. It's a long way to go. Right? There's a long way to go, but so far I have made changes in my life. My thoughts, my attitudes, my practice, my way of living, I have made changes. I have made improvements. So feel good. And that's inspiring. And then look forward. Okay, I have done good. I have a long way to go. The biggest truth about that is the change is possible, and we are making changes. So therefore, And then, yeah, when you bring into very simple language, in entire Buddhism is like we say Mahayana, or you know, like Theravada tradition into two, right? If possible, help others. That's Mahayana, bodhicitta. If not, do not harm others, or do not cause harm. That's the simple Theravada view, right? So before, we proclaim, we believe that we are a follower of Mahayana tradition, we practice bodhicitta. But before that, bodhicitta, we start with not causing harm. And then, if you take further steps, then go help others. But start from not causing harm. Right? So, thank you so much.
We have time for some questions.
Yes, please. Yes, please, questions.
Yes. Please, again, Rinpoche is serious when he says he wants a free exchange, so please feel free to ask any questions about the earlier talk or later.
Yes.
How did you feel when you found out that your own people were disappointed and went to the authorities to have you followed? How did you doubt yourself? Or were you disappointed?
Disappointing, yeah, maybe disappointing sometimes, but no doubt, no discouragement, no, yeah, absolutely. I try to be whenever those things happen, I try to be strong myself and try to check, reflect within myself that I don't respond otherwise, you know. So that becomes a practice. The hardest thing to me was with my teachers, you know, when my teachers were upset with my campaign, my work, that was the hardest thing. But again, you know, you just trying to find a middle way. And try to find a way to do it without, you know. Yes, please. Thank you.
You were a rebel, a delinquent. Can you tell us the transition from meat eating to vegetarian? You've explained that. What was the transition that you felt in your daily meditation?
Transition or meditation, what'd you say?
When you became vegetarian,
yeah.
Was there a transitional lift or change in your meditation?
I did not notice any particular thing. I have not focused on that particular thing. That how I'm doing now. That I'm moving towards. No, I did not. You know, I did not look into that. I think you're asking what was the differences, right? it made in my meditation from going to meat to the vegetarian. Right? That was your question? Yeah, I did not look into that particular thing, that how I'm doing. I did not. So if I say something, that would be a lie. Yes, please.
So you're suggesting that stopping the being a vegan vegetarian. What about those of us who wear and shoes?
Yeah. Yes, of course. Going vegan, meaning no animal product at all. That kind of, that's clear. Now, in vegetarianism, this is like modern Western thing. When vegan idea comes in, then that kind of puts vegetarianism in a different category, and you still use dairy things, animal products, and which means you still use leather shoes and all that. I always say, okay, the best, the goal is to go completely vegan, completely vegan, not using any animal product. That would be the best. But during the course of transition from, from here to there, you're trying to step by step, then the first thing I would request you to do by not eating meat is not using the fur. Fur is a horrifying thing. Leather, I would still say, is, in a way, is a side product. Animals are basically slaughtered for meat, not for the leather. Leather is a side product. Like you farmers grow, grains, hay comes with it. Hay is a part of the production, but that's not the main goal farmers, work for. Similarly, meat is the main goal of slaughtering animal. Leather comes with it. Not the worst thing, but the fur is completely different. If you look into the YouTube, just Google fur, you will see how furs are produced, mostly in China. They skin animal live. They skin out animal live. Just horrifying, just to watch, horrifying. So therefore, number one, please do not use fur. You're directly sponsoring that cruelty when you use the fur. Now I'm grateful that, lots of food companies producing many, many good vegan groceries, really good. And then also with the clothing, even the shoe, you can always go buy vegan shoes. Lots of good things available. So again, will is the number one thing. Mm-hmm. When you have a will, there's always a way. Thank you. Yes.
I'm really struck by what you said earlier about people always justify.
Yeah.
Everywhere Buddhists can justify, because I sort of justify a little fish in my diet, and I realize that's all I'm doing. And so to hear you say, that it's just justification, but it's really not Buddhist practice to be doing it. I realize I've just been kidding myself. Thank you.
And you see, I mean, also we need to know that there's no way that we can, like, make everything correct overnight. That's just not realistic. You know, we all have our own things to deal with, and but intent, have a goal. You intend to move that goal towards that goal, and then try to take, you know, steps, taking baby steps, slow by slow. You know, and you make it. Then you will really enjoy to. When you see the progress you make, you know, the progress you make, changes you make with your lifestyle, with your attitude, your beliefs, you know, all of that, your strength in dealing with issues, like, you know, with patience and tolerance. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've been involved in the animal rights movement for a while.
Thank you.
And it's very shameful, I must say, to be a Buddhist and to declare oneself a Buddhist in the environment among animal activists, the Pika people and humane associations and all. So it's very good. I'm very happy to meet you. I know of Shopkar, another organization.
Thank you.
A vegetarian.
Thank you.
And there are other teachers like Thich Nhat Hanh and others who do advocate homeless eating.
Mm-hmm.
And homeless eating is practiced in monastic situations in Korea and
absolutely.
China.
Yes.
The job, I feel, the Buddha's life for work is, you know, how to really, you know, develop the skill and means to really educate the general sangha, you know, the lay people.
Yeah.
About this. So I wonder what recommendations you may have. That's one question.
Yes.
The second one is,
yes.
Recently, 2 days ago, I met Holly Gailey, who you may know. She's lived in Eastern Tibet and she's an anthropologist and she studied in Eastern Tibet and she gave a presentation about your work in Colorado just yesterday. Amazing, but here I come to Tampa and I learned that you were here. It's extraordinary. We know that the Chinese have been decimating wildlife and the population of the Yaqui community in Tibet. Has your movement, how has that affected the ecology of Eastern Tibet? Has it had any effect at all?
I didn't hear the last part.
Has your movement had any effect in Eastern Tibet in the general environment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, to tell you the truth, personally, I have no reach in Tibet at all. You know, I left my country when I was 3, and I actually know nobody in Tibet. And there are some students who came from Tibet, have been in my monastery, my student, they finished their studies, they went back. But they are down in, mostly in Yunnan area. And, you know, we kind of stay away from communicating because when we communicate with them, they get in trouble. So I do not have lots of contacts in Tibet, personally. And like, you know, in Tibet, things change when His Holiness say a word. The people take very seriously. And then, because at some point, just a very stupid culture we had, Tibetans used lots of fur in decorating their chupas, what is that kind of gown we wear, you know, and then hat from the fox fur. And then it was tigers and so forth. A lot of Tibetan people use a lot of fur. And His Holiness, when His Holiness spoke about the fur issue, from all region of Tibet, people came out, you know, burnt all, you know, took a big movement to prevent the fur products. So it's a big achievement back in Tibet regarding fur. So yeah, but I can't say the whole Tibet 100%, you know, just difficult to say. But yeah, there has been a big effect from His Holiness' words.
So what alternatives to meat can you provide? Can you to give Tibetans, you know, in back in Tibet in the cold countries? Not in India, because they do have alternatives, but back in Tibet.
You know what? Again, I would still repeat the same thing. Will is the way, because Tibet is no more the way Tibet was. Tibet also share the modern technology now. They have lots of greenhouses and everything. Now, even in my area back, you know, like in the nomad area, people have greenhouses. You know, Tibet is no more like 100 years back, you know. Tibet also share the modern technology. So it's just about the will and awareness. So changes are coming, but it's a long way to go. Thank you. Yes.
This will be the last two.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
I understand not to be vegan and not dairy. I'm vegan myself, but what I wonder about, and I also wonder about my own practice, is having possibly a small farm in the future where an animal is part of the ecosystem to develop eco-friendly crops, but perhaps then introducing milk into my diet and knowing that the animal is treated okay. Do you think that relating to animals in that way is compassionate, or is it still kind of egocentric?
No, this is what I think, you know, like, like Buddha, when Buddha talked about vegetarianism, now the vegan is a new thing, you know, vegan, the whole idea of vegan was born in England in 1944. That's where vegan society came into exist. Because of the modern industrialization of animal, so vegan, the idea came into exist. But ancient time, the vegetarianism means plant-based food. Having said what Buddha had to say, but at the same time there were some exceptions, and that's where most of meat eating Buddhists kind of misinterpreted that part, you know. So what Buddha actually said was, he said, if you are hungry and nothing else to eat, and you find a dead animal, an animal that has died a natural death, and you have nothing else to eat, you are starving, then you can use that, because life is precious, you know. So what is approved by Buddha is to eat a natural dead animal. But that one nobody eats. Right? Right? So when I got liver cancer, I'm actually a liver cancer survivor. When I got the liver issue, the Indian doctors gave up on me back in India. And some of my students arranged me to go to Taiwan. They said Chinese medicine has a a good herbal medicine for the liver. So I went to Taiwan. And I met with the 4 different Chinese doctors, 2 herbal doctors, 2 allopathy doctors. They all came together. We had a meeting about my health issues. And all these doctors said, he said that my liver is very, very weak. It's just, you know, it's very chronic. You really need good protein. You have to eat meat. It's about your survival. And I said, I would rather choose to die. I would not eat meat. Then they said, you know, Gisela, could you take some fish, please? They said, it's important. And I said, fish is, you know, a type of meat to me. It's the same thing. I would not eat. Then they say, what about a little dairy like milk and egg? Then I said, I can think about that. Because back in India, in our own family, we raise our own chicken, we raise our own cows, we have our own milk. So I know they have their own natural life. So there's, because by then, because I was already vegan, I learned from American students. You know, I have some really, really good American students I met in Harvard when I first spoke at Harvard. So I was already vegan then, and now I have this liver issue. Then I said, okay, I can think about that. Because I thought back in India, you know, you have your own chickens and cows and, you know, that's a kind of the approved one from Buddhist perspective. So I'm sharing this story with you. So if you have your own, you know, backyard animal and you treat the animal in a natural way, compassionately, there's nothing wrong using that. Right? It's because why we are pursuing vegetarianism or veganism for a reason. It's not dogmatic. It's not kind of a black and white thing for a reason. So it's just when you are not further causing suffering, then it's okay, I think. Right? Make sense? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.